Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After celebrated World War II novelist James Jones died at the age of 55, his then 16-year-old daughter made sure that she attended college as he wanted. During her years at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, another writer was born, Keeley Jones. Since then, Keeley has written five novels, including A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, which was later made into a movie. But none of that comes close to describing her early life among some of the most celebrated writers of our time, living in Paris, where she was born, basking on glamorous beaches, regularly gathering in exclusive restaurants, and eavesdropping on her parents' gatherings, routine Sunday extravaganzas that included plenty of alcohol. After her father died, Keeley went to college, but she also went into an emotional and alcoholic tailspin. Her latest book, Lies My Mother Never Told Me, is a memoir that details all of this, her young, seemingly fairy tale life in Paris and Sagaponack, New York, in the 1960s and 70s, through the death of her parents, their personal struggles, and her own battle with alcoholism. Finally, Keeley Jones wrote about her mother and their relationship, one of extremes, extreme loyalty, extreme cruelty, extreme drinking, and extreme breakdown. And wow, what an intro, Keeley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You have said that at first, after someone suggested you write a memoir, you were sort of horrified at the prospect. Why was that?
There's no buffer between the truth and yourself. I think when you write a memoir with fiction, you can always say, well, it was a novel. It was fiction. I made it up, even if it's based on personal experience. Nowadays, I think with all this reality TV and tell-all memoirs, it's very hard to convince anybody to read anything if it's not what they consider the truth. So I think on some level, the memoir has taken away that buffer of being able to get away with calling it fiction.
You were also coached by your dad, though, about what the truth is and how important truth is to writing.
Absolutely. And I think on that level, this book demanded to be a memoir. It had to be. I couched my drinking and my mother's drinking in fiction for years and years, trying to just keep it a little bit under wraps so I wasn't exposing myself completely. And I realized that I couldn't do that anymore. And this book really demanded to be called a memoir and to be as truthful as I could make it.
You met Susan Cheever on a street corner in New York.
Right. She's a friend. She lives in my neighborhood. I've known her a long time.
Another famous child of a famous author.
Who also was a drinker.
Right. We've heard. Yeah. And she's the one that suggested to you to write a memoir. But you had come to her. Why did you even bring up the subject at that point?
We always talk about what's happening in the book world, you know, complaining a lot. And my mother had just passed away, and I was walking my two dogs, and she had her dog, who's a really mean dog, called Sweetie. And Sweetie always attacks my dogs. But we were walking, and she said, "How are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm not very well." And my mother had just passed away. She knew the whole story. And I said, well, kind of laughing without much humor, that my godmother had said, "Well, the silver lining is it'll make a great novel." And Susan snorted and said, "This isn't going to be a novel. This is a memoir."
Why was it? What's the distinction? I mean, why was it important to make this a memoir versus a novel, like you did with A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, is based on your life?
I think nobody would believe it.
Okay.
I mean, I truly think there are aspects of this book that are so unbelievable that, well, here's the thing. If you grew up in a family where the secret is that they're alcoholics, but everybody pretends this is not the case, what's the point of writing that as fiction? Fiction is another layer of, fiction basically means you've made it up. So by eliminating that, you're saying, this is my truth. And I thought this book really demanded that. It's like putting up a flag and marching right into enemy territory with a big flag up. That's what it felt like anyway.
How long did you spend writing the book?
It took me about 14 months to do the first draft, and then another several months of revision with my agent, and then another several months of revision with the editor who finally took the book, Henry Ferris, from HarperCollins.
The title. Tell me about that.
Well, the title, the first title—
Just to remind the listeners, Lies My Mother Never Told Me.
The first title was Shakespeare's Children, which they said anything that has Shakespeare in it scares people away. You can't, it's too complicated, that title, which was from Faulkner's daughter. He told her once when he was drunk that nobody remembers Shakespeare's child, so who cares what you think when I'm drunk? And I thought that was a marvelous title, but they didn't like it. So Lies My Mother Never Told Me is really about the fact that it's almost like a mathematical equation. My father always used to say, you know, your mother is the most honest person I've ever met. She never tells lies. She always tells the truth. But of course, he never heard her say the things to me that she said that were really nasty or horrible. So if my mother says I'm not an alcoholic, there is no problem here, then clearly I'm insane. And she's right, because she always tells the truth. So she never lies. So these are the lies she never told me. I mean, if everything's fundamentally based on a lie, how do you recognize what's true or what's not true, and where's the gray area?
Is it what is not said instead of what is said?
It's what's said. Everything is said, and everything is said as if it's totally okay to tell people what you really think all the time with no buffer, which I think is what alcohol does in a sense. It takes away that cultural sort of, you know, lock we have on ourselves where we contain what we really want to say to people. And like the Woody Allen movie where there's the subtitles of what people are really thinking right. as opposed to what they're really saying. My mother didn't have that. She would just say it. But so she was not a liar. She never told lies. So it's the lies she never told me.
He said that to you, though, when you were quite young.
Yeah, he said it a lot. Your mother's the most honest person I've ever met. She never lies. She never makes things up. It's not true.
But he said that, at least in the book that the part of the book that I remember was after you had come to him and said, I think mother hates me, or you had said something.
We had a fight, I think, and you know, and I was in despair. I was little, and he tended to treat children like small adults. He didn't differentiate. So he said, basically, he put the onus on both of us, not just her or me. He'd say, you need to work on getting along with her. You know, the problem with your mother is she always tells the truth, and it's kind of brutal because she doesn't restrain herself. Well, that was only partly true. That was not the whole truth, clearly.
The title, A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, is the same number of syllables, and it also has the word never in it.
I know,
so
isn't that
really
cool?
Strong universal. Yeah, I kept thinking about that, and then I actually counted on my fingers and figured that out this morning. At the start of each chapter, you relate vignettes, is the best way I can describe it. But you always, mostly from your mother's past, I think all of them from your mother.
They're all my mother's stories.
In terms of your mother and why did you do that instead of just weave those stories into the story, the larger story?
At first, they just weren't there at first at all. And it was the book needed a lot more humor, and it also needed to show a fair portrait of her. And I thought, what better way to show a fair portrait of her than let her talk, let her tell her, you know, let the stories come through sort of my ears as I perceived her stories and as I recollected them. So anybody who knew her knows all those stories because there were a million dinners where she would tell the same stories. There's also, if you noticed, a kind of falling apart of the stories as you go along. The stories start to get more dire, and she starts to repeat things and doesn't always get everything straight. So the stories sort of take a dramatic arc too, you know, and sort of start to get more tragic as the book goes on. And that was my intention, was to show a kind of a different kind of arc where things are getting worse with her stories.
You said you'd tell them a million times, and you, of course, overheard them then a million times because you would eavesdrop on their parties. What was that like in Paris their big blasts?
Well, I also heard them when I was older, too, because eventually I grew up and got to sit at the dinner table.
Okay.
You know, my mother still had—
She was still telling them that.
Yes, she certainly was. My husband always jokes and says, she's the only person I know who would have a children's table when we're in our 40s. You know, she'd put all the kids at another table, which is just at holidays, you know, like Thanksgiving.
Well,
that's the children's table. And my husband's like, we're 40 years old, and we're at the children's table. But, you know, she would tell these stories to the point where it was like rewind and play. You know, all you needed was a little cassette, and she would tell these stories, and some of them were truly hilarious. But by the 800th time, it's a little bit annoying. So for me, it was so easy to just plug into that memory and just hit the button and play those stories. And actually, I think some of them are truly hilarious.
Tell me one of your favorites.
Well, the one when she got into bed with the German couple in Switzerland is so... She was...
Where were you then?
We were in Kloster, Switzerland on vacation, and my father was away. So he was in Vietnam doing articles. And so my mother and I shared a room, and my brother had a room down, you know, down the hall. And she just didn't look at the number on the door. And, of course, it was Switzerland. Nobody locked doors back then. So she went out drinking and left me, you know, to go to sleep. And I went to sleep, and she snuck back in. And there were two entrances to the building, and she just counted the floors. She didn't look at the room number on the door. So she came in on a different floor and counted the floors and got, you know, walked into the room in the complete darkness, dropped all her clothes on the floor, everything including her underwear, got into the bed. And it wasn't me. It was this German couple, and they didn't think it was funny. They were mortified. They thought she was some kind of crazy woman.
Luckily, she heard him snort or snore
snoring,
or something before she fell asleep.
Right. Can you imagine waking up the next morning? I mean, and of course, she had several cocktails, I mean, that night, too. And, you know, so it was one of the funniest, most embarrassing things that ever happened to her. But the way she told it was so funny that the embarrassment sort of got lost in the retelling, you know.
Yeah, she sort of lived through all of our worst fears of being naked in public.
Exactly. You know? With a German couple, no less.
German couple. And they wanted to kick her out of the hotel, but somebody interceded.
Yes, it was Erwin Shaw's ex-wife, Marion, lived there, and she knew this lady, the owner of the hotel, and she said it was an honest mistake. She was not trying to seduce the German couple. You know? It's just so crazy. And so they let us stay.
And did you know about that story right after it happened?
Oh, yeah. I was in the bed, you know, when she came in.
She came right back and told you.
She finally found the right room and was laughing hysterically in her mink coat with nothing on underneath. And she snuck out of the room. And she forgot her purse in the room, so they figured out who she was. It wasn't a very big hotel either. But the thing that's so funny is that she said if they'd only been French, they would have seen the humor in this. But they were German, and they didn't think this was funny at all.
There's another one, not to just completely go up the stories. There's many, many stories in the book, and they're all funny. You're right. There is an arc to them, though. There's like a breakup and a disintegration, a sense of disintegration at the end. But the one with Frank Sinatra after your father died and Warren Bacall's advice.
Yeah. We can't say that on the air, though.
No, you can't say that particular word. But let's think of a euphemism.
Well, that's a story that is so famous that every widow that my mother knew now tells that story. You know, when somebody dies, well, my mother was, you know, just paralyzed after my father died. And after a few days, she was so bad that they thought she was really seriously going to try to kill herself. So they finally called Lauren Bacall, they called Betty and said, you have to come right away. You know, Gloria's in really bad shape. My mother loved and admired and respected her. So she came over and she said, don't do anything stupid. I understand you can't get off the couch and that's fine, but you know, don't sell the house. Don't sell everything right away. Don't do anything stupid. And for God's sakes, don't have sex with Frank Sinatra, which is what she did when Humphrey Bogart died. And she said it much more colorfully than
yes.
that. She's renowned also for her colorful language. And my mother laughed so hard she finally got up.
And it worked, and Frank Sinatra did call her.
And he called a few days later and he said, hi, it's Frank. And my mother said, Frank who? And he was offended, you know, as if she knew no one else in the world called Frank. There were no other Franks. And he said, do you want me to come out there and see you? Are you okay? And my mother, again, started to laugh and couldn't stop. So I think that humor is what pulled her through that absolutely horrible time. And it's the only funny story she ever told about around that period of my father's death.
We're going to take a short break. If you would like to join the conversation with writer Kaylee Jones, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 69 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. At 1 o'clock, On Point will be here. Is the global economic crisis derailing globalization? Should it? As the G20 sits down in Pittsburgh, On Point talks tires, chickens, and trade. That's an On Point today at 1, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy skies, a chance of rain showers, and a high of 77 degrees. Clouds tonight and a low right around 60. For Friday, sunshine in the morning and then cloudy in the afternoon, and a high of 78 degrees. Looking ahead to Saturday, rain, maybe a thunderstorm on Saturday, and a little chillier with a high of only 68. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich, and now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Kaylee Jones about her latest book, It's a Memoir, about her life as a child of a famous writer, James Jones, and her relationship with her mother in the long wake of his death. You often have suggested in the book at different points that you don't deserve to be somewhere or to get something, get into college at Wesleyan or advance on your first novel from Doubleday. There's other instances and moments or very small moments, maybe not as momentous. But you said it took you 5 years after the Doubleday deal before you – and a whole novel later before you finally began to feel that you had earned your own place, that you deserved what you had.
I, you know, in retrospect now, I do believe I've earned everything that I've gotten, and I worked very, very hard at becoming a good writer. I worked very, very hard at it. It didn't come absolutely naturally to me. The door was open. But if you think about Hollywood, you know, almost every many directors and actors are second generation and had contacts. But that doesn't give you the talent. It just gives you the contact. And I think a lot more people use those contacts than you would think. But when I was younger, I did think that I didn't deserve it. I did think that everything I got because I was James Jones's daughter, not because I had a particular talent. I see that differently now, obviously, years later. But at the time, I really felt like there was something really huge I needed to live down, and that was very difficult.
There was a teacher of yours, a writing teacher at Ohio Wesleyan. I know he's a famous writer, and I can't think of his name right now. But he was tough on you in your first workshop with him. Didn't cut you any slack. And
yeah.
You met him in a restaurant where you were working.
Yeah, that was Richard Price, actually, and that was at Columbia. Wesleyan in Connecticut, and then I went to Columbia University for my MFA, and Richard Price wrote The Wanderers. He was from the South Bronx, and he didn't get any kind of free ride at all. Now he's a very famous screenwriter and novelist, and he wrote Clockers, but many other books. Yeah, he didn't give me an inch, and the other person who was in the class that he was also very hard on was Susan Minot, who wrote Monkeys and other such wonderful novels, and he just felt like we'd gotten too much of a break in our lives. But he eventually came around.
He came around because you kind of were a little in his face and said, you were really tough on me. And he said, you know what? And you didn't expect him to admit it. But then he said, you know what? You're right. I was.
It's true. It was. And I was also, I'd had a great number of cocktails that night.
Yes.
I was sick. Yeah, I was very, I had bronchitis and I just couldn't not go to the party, the end of term class party. So I had about 9 drinks, and then I confronted him. I said, you were really hard on me. And he immediately backed down, said, yeah, you know, you're right. And please take my class again, and I'll give you another chance. And so I said, sure. And it ended up being a good relationship for me. And I'm actually very glad that he put that kind of pressure on me at that time. I thought that was actually not bad for me.
Yeah, you were lucky to have someone push you and not coddle you because of who you were. But, you know, who you were was one thing, but your resources weren't necessarily great.
No, I didn't have money at the time at all.
You had to work.
I did. And, my father spent more than he made, and he made quite a lot of money over many years on his many books. But they lived very high. They lived in Paris, and they, you know, the Keeping Up with the Joneses, my gosh, they were the Joneses, you know, and they spent so much money. And I think my mother was more like that than my father. I think he just kind of went along with it, but he complained a lot about how much money they were spending. Finally, we had to move back to the States, and we lived in Miami for a year, and he taught, you know, graduate courses in writing. And then we moved out to Long Island and sold the house in Paris. So things were not great when he died. I mean, the money situation was okay, but it was not fabulous.
You had to work.
Yeah.
And they offered you a fellowship at Columbia. And when they found out who you were, they asked you to give it back.
Yeah, because they, I found out later, you know, which was actually a good thing, that they read the submissions blind. So they didn't know who I was.
Which felt good to you on one level, yeah.
It was great. And then when I went to register, they said, oh, listen, we didn't know that you were James Jones's daughter. And since you have money, can you give up your scholarship to the next person who really has no money? And I didn't want to give up the scholarship. I didn't have the kind of money they were talking about. You know, I really didn't. So I didn't give up the scholarship.
And you ended up becoming pretty good friends with the
Beverly
person.
Beverly D'Onofrio. Yeah, she's my I still feel guilty about that. She definitely needed it more than I did. She was 32 and had this 16-year-old kid. She wrote that book called Riding in Cars with Boys, which was made into a Drew Barrymore movie. And we're very, very good friends now. But the funniest thing is that, you know, one day she said, some rich bitch took my scholarship. And it was me. And I was so embarrassed that I didn't tell her for 24 years.
And what did she say? She just...
At that point, she laughed because she ended up making so much more money than I did ever on that film and that book that, you know, she by that time, it was kind of water under the bridge.
Right. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am speaking with Kaylee Jones about her latest book. It's a memoir about her life as a child of the famous writer James Jones and her mother, Gloria Jones. I was wondering what inspired your second novel, Quite the Other Way. It was about the Soviet Union. And I know that you started studying Russian when you were 7 or 8 years old, something like that.
Yeah, but I always was fascinated by Russian literature. And I had this fabulous Russian teacher in Paris, this old lady who sort of escaped from Russia during the Communist Revolution and came to France. And she was such one of the best teachers I'd ever had. And that sort of hands-on teaching where people really expose themselves and show their hand, I love. I think that's the best way to teach. That's how I teach. And she was great. And I just continued and continued, went to college and started studying Russian again. And finally, I just was really interested. You know, I grew up, my youth, my young adult years were during the Reagan era.
Right.
And I disagreed a great deal with his position on the Soviet Union. And I wanted to go there just to see for myself if they were truly an empire of evil. And, you know, would I be willing to fight these people? What the people who wrote those books, you know, whose legacy was that unbelievable 19th century Russian literature, even 20th century poetry like Anna Akhmatova and things like that, you know, would I fight those people? And I wanted to go and find out for myself. And I loved Russia. The people were amazing. I just really loved it as a country, and I thought the people were amazing.
What was that novel about?
It was about American students going to Russia and studying in Moscow. And the backstory was a girl whose father had been a journalist in Russia during World War II, who'd gotten in trouble for taking the Russian side after the war. And so she goes back to find out what his life was about there and meets people who knew him when he was young.
You did that. You went back to your father's hometown.
Yeah.
I want to talk about in a second. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Kaylee Jones about her latest book. It's a memoir, Lies My Mother Never Told Me. Kaylee is going to be appearing tonight doing a reading at the Thurber House at 7:30. It will be at the Columbus Performing Arts Center at 549 Franklin Avenue. If you'd like more information about tickets, call the Thurber House at 614-464-1032 or check out their website, thurberhouse.org, T-H-U-R-B-E-R, house.org. I wasn't too long ago. It was before you wrote the memoir that you went and visited the town. Now it's Robinson.
I go there a lot.
You do?
Yeah. The first time I went was in 1982, and I was 21, and I went with this biographer who was doing the first sort of formal biography of my dad's. And so I'd never been there, and I really wanted to go to Robinson, Illinois, which is southern Illinois. It's about an hour from Terre Haute, Indiana, a couple of hours from Indianapolis.
In the middle of nowhere.
Southern Illinois, very, right. Very much southern Illinois. And I went with this crazy biographer who was a Harvard graduate who was so out of his element. I mean, you know, it was kind of wild, but I met a lot back then in the early 80s. There were still a good number of people who were still alive who knew my dad. And that was great because I got to meet people who'd known him as a young man.
Had
I met his first girlfriend.
Yeah. Had that ever occurred to you before to go there, or was it completely spurred by this the biographer.
Well, I had no way to get there, sort of, and no incentive to go before. My mother pretended that anything that happened before she met my dad had never didn't exist. It was as if he was born at 30, you know, 7 years old. He'd had no life before that. But that's actually a pretty large chunk of somebody's life that he'd lived before he met my mother. The war she thought was fine because he made a lot of money off World War II, and that was fine. But after between the end of World War II and his meeting her, those years, as far as she was concerned, had never happened. He had a very, very long relationship with an older woman who'd taken him in and helped him put From Here to Eternity together. She was dead by the time I went to Robinson. But I met a lot of people who had known him and who loved him. And that was really fantastic for me because it felt familiar. Robinson, Illinois. I mean, I grew up in France and, you know, Long Island. And here I arrive in this town. I didn't have – the accent was so familiar to me. I felt like I knew everybody there from his books and from the way he spoke and from his whole worldview. These people were very much like he was. You could tell the roots of his personality were from that town. I found out a lot of very interesting things about his childhood.
What did you learn that stuck with you?
I learned he was physically abused by his mother, who was the quote-unquote good one in the family. You know, his father was an alcoholic.
Hadn't you suspected it before then, though? Hadn't he given you hints that—
He hated his mother.
Right.
And he'd say that. I hated my mother. He'd say that right out.
But you never knew why.
No, not really. Okay. I knew she was mean to him. But he didn't explain too much. But he wrote short stories about it. Some of his very best short stories are for the little boy that he was writing about his relationship with his parents. And what I love about those stories is he presents the facts. You know, here's the good upstanding citizen and here's, you know, this terrible drunken father. And which one do you like? Which one is the one that you feel is telling the truth in the story? So everything's turned on its head. You know, from a child's perspective, I loved that. And it was really interesting going there and meeting people who still loved him and missed him. I found out funny stories. For example, I met a guy who'd been a caddy at the golf course when my dad had written From Here to Eternity and had a lot of money. He showed up at the golf course in his hometown in cutoff jeans, cowboy boots, all this amazing silver Navajo jewelry he'd bought and a cowboy hat and brand new beautiful clubs that he'd just bought and wanted to play golf. And the whole town was absolutely scandalized. They didn't know what to do, but he was famous and he had money. And so the kid took him around, you know, he played golf. And he had enough money. And I think his family had been in this golf course for so long, they couldn't really kick him off the golf course. But it was so hilarious. The story was so funny. And the kid said, well, he wasn't very good. Of course, he'd just gotten out of the army and, you know, bought these brand new golf clubs, but he wasn't a great golfer. But those kinds of things, I found out that he had the sort of same sense of humor as a young guy as he did when he got older. And I made friends there that I still have, that I think of as family.
But by the time you went back, the writer's colony, the artist colony that had started up in his wake was gone.
Yeah, the colony was gone. The house that the sort of grounds on which the colony had been built were the house was burned down. His house was still there. He'd built himself a house right behind the colony grounds. The colony was started by this woman, Loni Handy, the one that he'd had this long, long, long relationship with. But he poured a lot of money into it. He poured a great sum of money from Here to Eternity money into this colony to help young writers coming back from the war. At that point, there were also Korean veterans who came to the colony, lots of young men who had the experience of war and had nowhere to go, really, when they got back. He took them in. And I think that's pretty wonderful. And he built this house. And the funniest thing is that house, even though it's passed from hand to hand, many, many different people have bought it since then, looked just like him.
Like what?
Well, the same design as our house in Paris. He loved secret entryways and he had trap doors. He had a library that opened up into a game room. I mean, for what reason? There was no reason, but he loved that. He loved secret spaces and bookshelves everywhere, you know, and huge bathrooms. He loved huge bathrooms. And the guy that owned the house said, look, the first bidet in all of Crawford County, you know, and I guess I don't know where my father had even ever heard of a bidet in his life. But he put one in, you know, and this huge with naked mermaids swimming on the glass. I mean, he was wild that way. It's very funny.
He meets your mother and they marry and they're in Robinson and he has a problem with Lonnie.
Yeah.
They get in a fight. There's a conflict. And they take off.
He didn't exactly tell the truth. You know, he didn't say to my mother, by the way, you know, this is my mistress for 20 years.
Yeah.
Or not 20, but at that point, I guess 12 or 14 years. This is my mistress that I've had an affair with for 15 years, and that's her husband, and we're all very good friends, and everything's okay. No, he told her, this is my foster mother.
Okay.
And of course, you know, Loni wasn't thrilled because, well, she had said to him, you need to get married. You know, this is over between us. You need to get married. So, okay, he gets married, but she wasn't expecting him to marry, you know, somebody who looked like Marilyn Monroe, who was, you know, funny and incredibly beautiful and intelligent and all these things. And it was a disaster from the word go. So, yes, there was a big confrontation. And my mother found out the truth and they almost broke up over it after being married for 6 weeks.
And they just picked up and left. And one thing that stuck with me was the few things they took. You mentioned the Navajo jewelry.
Yes, that same old
now
Navajo
jewelry. That was really important. He spent a lot on that, or it was important to him.
It was important. I guess it was important to my mother. Apparently, he took nothing. He walked out of the house with the shoes on his feet, and that's it. Nothing. It's my mother who piled the stuff into the back of the car, according to her. I don't really know because I can't find out how that all turned out. How his stuff, the stuff that ended up with us, ended up with us. I know she threw some things in the back, like the silverware and this beautiful tea set that my great-great-grandmother had or something. And the manuscript, I think, he put in the car. The manuscript of Some Came Running, which he wouldn't have left his manuscript. But he left the manuscript of From Here to Eternity there, which ended up with the Loni Handy children.
He left everything. He walked away from everything. He didn't sell that house. He didn't.
Nothing.
He just never went back.
No, he walked away. Somebody did sell it for him. There was a power of attorney situation where this local lawyer, you know, did sell it all and clean out the estate. But I don't know what happened there either and how much he didn't care. He didn't care. He said, I don't care. Do what you want to do. Just send me a check. I don't care. He was very my father. When he closed the door, he closed the door. You know, he never, but he used to say when I was young, I mean, he did say, we'll go back there someday, but we never did.
We're going to take a short break. If you would like to join the conversation with writer Kaylee Jones, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is Capital City Radio.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World.
And this is Capital City Radio.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org. And good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock for Hour 2 of All Sides. We'll hear two points of view about payday lending in Ohio. Critics charge that payday lending industry has found new ways to charge excessive interest fees. We'll get reaction from both sides to state legislation introduced to close the so-called loopholes. That's coming up at 11 o'clock on All Sides, right here on WOSU 820. Currently 71 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40. In the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy skies, a chance of rain showers and a high of 77. Clouds tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Morning sunshine on Friday, followed by a cloudy afternoon and a high of 78. Looking ahead to Saturday, a good chance of rain on Saturday, maybe even a thunderstorm, and a little chilly for Saturday with a high of 68 degrees. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Kaylee Jones about her latest book. It's a memoir about her life as a child of James and Gloria Jones. The name of the memoir is Lies My Mother Never Told Me. In Chapter 9, you say that the hardest part about giving up drinking yourself is not giving up drinking, but getting your family to accept that you are an alcoholic. And I've heard that before from other people. But in your case, it sounded like it was to the power of 100. It was sort of verboten. You could not – to say the word alcoholism or alcoholic in your house was – It was probably never said you can't say it, but you just never did.
No, you never did. And if somebody was an alcoholic, it was a true stain on their reputation and their lives. And it was the worst thing you could be. Clearly, it was like – because if you're an alcoholic, it meant you had to stop drinking. And the last thing in the world was stopping was out of the question. You know, my mother – and especially, you know, after my father died, it only got worse. And a lot of people used to say, you know, well, your mom really wasn't an alcoholic until – your father died. But I know that's not true, because what I started to remember was that she would pack scotch in suitcases when we were little, when we went traveling, because the idea of getting someplace and there being no booze there was so terrifying to her that that was like the one thing that never got forgotten. And the biggest thing is, when I stopped drinking, to her that was a personal insult. She wasn't able to recognize that it really was a life or death situation ultimately. For me, I had to stop. And when I told her that, and I said, it has nothing to do with you, you know, this is nothing to do with you, that didn't sink in at all. It was a personal affront to her. I was basically telling her, I was judging her on some level because I stopped drinking.
You were also one of her drinking buddies.
Yeah, I was a big drink. You know, I used to tell him when I had a job, I'd say to the boss, you know, like, I'm probably not going to be in great shape tomorrow because I'm going out with my mom tonight. You know, my mother was the worst influence on me around. We'd go to Elaine's and close the place down and get in all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering, I wondered, what did you do? Because your relationship was conflicted.
Yeah. Well,
back then, a bottle of wine or, you know, whatever would...
Drinking was, you know, we didn't, you know, you don't talk much with people like that. There was never a real discussion going on of anything of substance. So being out drinking with her, it wasn't just us. There was always – people would walk in. There'd always be another person with us. Or she was not a person who liked a one-on-one conversation with anybody. There always had to be three people or more. She was not a one-on-one kind of person at all.
What was it like being around all those famous people? I know it's hard. You don't have any perspective because that's the way you grew up, but –
Well, I didn't even know they were famous until I went to college, really. I didn't realize, that
James started reading their books. She said.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize James Baldwin was that famous until I went to college and he was on all the American novelists, you know, 20th century American writers reading lists.
Right.
And I was amazed. I mean, William Styron and all these people, they were all, Truman Capote and Cold Blood was absolutely just on every reading list. And I didn't know it. When I was a child, that I just thought they were wild and crazy and amusing friends of my parents, you know. And I was too young. I mean, really, my father died when I was 16. And at 16, kids are not thinking about the literary canon, about understanding and reading books. So I never really gave too much thought to what I was going to be missing. You don't when you're a teenager. You're very self-centered and you don't think about that stuff. He and I read books together and talked about books, but not till the very end of his life, almost as if he was preparing me somehow for the future.
He made up reading lists for you.
Yeah, but at the very end, last year of his life.
But he did read, I thought it was very sweet, the E.B. White.
Stuart Little,
when you were in France?
Yeah, when we were about seven.
And he would sit around the table and...
And he read us all of Stuart Little, and then the next summer he read us the entire Odyssey, too.
Yeah.
And he was a great reader. He made it really come alive.
When your mom would call you up and ask you to, you know, I'm out at Elaine's, get over here, and you didn't want to say no. You were sort of afraid to say no.
Well, yeah, but when I stopped drinking, I had to say no.
Right.
Because it was a question of me being able to survive. And I knew if I went to Elaine's, I wouldn't be able to do it. So I started to say no. And that really did not go down well with her.
What did she do?
Well, she would be, you know, she would be, all she had to do is be displeased. She didn't really even have to say anything. It was more the tone of voice. She would pout or be displeased. And this is something that I think only children from alcoholic homes or from dysfunctional homes understand, the level of the pain that's caused by displeasing the parent or the withdrawal of love from the parent. And I think she was very good at that, at just shutting me out or closing me down when I didn't do things her way. And she could also say really really biting things.
She started when you were very young saying very mean things.
Yeah. And I don't think she – I was thinking about this earlier. How aware was she of what she was saying? I don't think she realized what she was saying. I don't think that most people mean to be really cruel. I think people really have all kinds of reasons to explain away their meanness, and they're always justified in their own minds.
You were concerned when you had your own child. How old is your child?
She's going to be 12 in November.
12. I have a 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. And at one point you heard yourself or your husband heard you say something sharp to her.
Yeah, what's the matter with you?
What's the matter with you? And tell me what he said to that.
Well, I didn't even know I was saying it. Mm-hmm. That was the heart. I was 5 years sober when she was born. So in 1997, I was 5 years sober, and when she was about three or something, she did something. I don't know what it was, and I said, "What's the matter with you?" And my husband said, "You know, you sound just like your mother when you say that." And I felt a chill run down my spine. Like, I was floored by this. I didn't even know I'd said it. That's the truth. So I had to start finding out how to stop doing that. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be like her and say those things to my daughter. And I read some books. And I talked to this wonderful therapist who's an expert in adult children of alcoholics issues, which I think is, if you're an adult child of an alcoholic, you need to speak to an adult child of an alcoholic counselor. Speaking to somebody who's not a specialist in that field is not valuable, in my opinion.
What's the extra value that they bring to it?
They understand the syndrome, and they understand the exact nature of the behavior patterns that are passed down. I mean, you may not be an alcoholic with the booze, but you still are an alcoholic in your behavior, even if you don't drink. And those issues have to be addressed. And that's why very often it skips a generation. Like the child of an alcoholic won't drink, will say, I'm never going to drink. But the behavior is the same. And then the child is born, and then that child grows up to be an alcoholic. And nobody can understand why. Nobody drank in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the grandparents, usually, or an aunt or an uncle, and that the behavior passes down, and how to recognize the behavior and understand the behavior, I think, is why you need a specialist in that field. And this lady that I and my husband also went to was 32 years sober herself and had, spent years and years and years mapping out behavior patterns of children of alcoholics, and also why we're not able to talk to each other, why there's so much misunderstanding in the language. For example, I might say to my husband at 11 o'clock at night, "Oh, I forgot to get half and half." And he'd get up and get his coat. And I'd say, "Where are you going?" "Well, didn't you just tell me to get half and half?" "No, I didn't tell you to get half and half. I said I forgot to get half and half." Well, to him, that meant I just said, "Go get half and half." And that's a very simple and mm-hmm. Really not a serious example. But that kind of thing could happen, and misunderstandings can really brew from that kind of, you never know what the other person's saying. Somebody said that to me yesterday that I met at a reading the day before yesterday in New York City. She said, "I grew up feeling like I was crazy, that I was absolutely crazy because everything was off." And I think that's exactly right.
You mentioned that in your book, you felt crazy sometimes.
Yeah.
Is it me or is it, when you it was very important to you not to repeat the same patterns with your daughter. Ironically, though, your mother adored your daughter.
Yeah, that's something else I found too in reading books on dysfunction in families. Very often, it skips a generation. John Bradshaw, whom I just adore, he was a priest, and he's really a layman in his explanations, and it's very simple and clear. He was a priest, was an alcoholic, gave up the priesthood, gave up drinking, and is really somebody who gives simple explanations to very complicated emotional traumas. One of the things that he says in his book called Family Secrets is that if a grandmother is abused, she will behave a certain way towards her daughter, like, terrified of relationships. You must never get in a relationship. The daughter will be promiscuous. The granddaughter will be the opposite again, will be completely reacting to the mother. And the grandmother and the grandchild will get along beautifully and there will be no problem between them. So it's this kind of pendulum swing. And my mother, for some reason, was obsessed with my daughter. This is the child. She used to say things like, this is the only child I've ever loved.
Wow.
But she would say it to my brother. My brother has two kids. You know, this is the grandchild that I adore, she'd say. And my brother has two children the same age.
Why do you think she did that with your daughter?
I don't know. And mm-hmm. I don't know why she would say, though. I don't think she had a clue what she was saying to my brother or to me. You know, this is the child I've loved the most in the world. To me, her own daughter. And she didn't put together the fact that my daughter was a good child because she had good parents. This was irrelevant to her. We didn't exist in the picture. Mm-hmm. Her primary focus was to get rid of us. You know.
Well, in fact, for a few years, 2 or 3 years, she kept from you her drinking. She had said she quit. She did quit for a while.
She had to quit. She almost died. She had cirrhosis and was, you know, really couldn't get up, couldn't walk. And she refused to go to the hospital or to a treatment center, so we held vigil. I stayed with her for something like 7 weeks. And finally, this liver specialist told her, you know, if you ever drink again, you're going to die. I mean, she told the liver specialist that she really didn't drink that much, that this had happened because she was bored, but she really wasn't an alcoholic. And the liver specialist said, I don't care if you call it dandelion disease. You know, if you drink, you die. And I guess my mother didn't believe it. You know, she thought, well, they're all silly. You know, I can control this. And so she waited a while. I know she didn't drink for quite a while. I mean, it scared her, certainly. But she started again. And when she started again, it was in secret. And then from there to the end, it was all hidden.
And it was hidden from you. Other people knew, but it was hidden from you so that she could see your daughter.
Right. Other people eventually knew. Not at first, I don't think. But eventually people started to know because she did things like water down the scotch in their apartments and, you know, she had bottles hidden everywhere. My daughter is the one who showed me where all the bottles were hidden after my mother died. She went around the house pointing out all the hiding places for the booze. And it's sad to me, terrible. I feel so sad that my daughter had to go through. I thought I'd protected her from this disease, and clearly I didn't.
How did you feel about the fact that you missed it for so long? That was it sort of a sense of denial, like you'd failed again? How could I miss this? How could I not know?
There's no question that I was in complete denial that she was drinking again. There's no question. And I wrote a lot about this in the book, but I don't understand how that could have happened, how I could have been. My husband said the same thing. He could not understand how the two of us just didn't see it, her behavior, her attitude, everything. But she was now with a few years later, I think back and I think to myself, you know what? This poor woman must have suffered so much hiding this from us, this whole, just so that she could be with our daughter, that she must have been in agony hiding this booze all over the place mm-hmm. and thinking, well, they're coming tomorrow, so I better not drink tonight because then I'll smell, you know, and having to plan it all out so carefully. No wonder she was in a rage at me all the time.
And that lasted right up until
she died. Yeah.
You know, there was a poem. I loved this poem, and you saw it on a poster in a crosstown bus in New York City one time, and it's by Langston Hughes, and it's called Luck. Sometimes a crumb falls from the tables of joy. Sometimes a bone is flung. To some people, love is given. To others, only heaven. And I love it, and it gives me chills.
Me
but
too.
I'm wondering, what does that say to you?
Well, that day that I saw it on the bus, I hadn't been sober all that long. I was on my way to work to teach. And I saw that poem, and I burst into tears on the bus. I was doubled over, weeping from that poem. And in fact, I read that poem to my daughter the other day because she's doing a Langston Hughes thing in her class, and that's not the poem they read. They read another one, mm-hmm. and I started crying. And she said, why are you crying? And then I recited that poem to her, and I said, this man opened the door to me to understanding what it's like to have no love, what it feels like to feel that you're being thrown scraps in life. You know, I just... I think that poem is brilliant.
It is. It's fantastic. I loved it. And thank you for bringing that to me. I'm talking with Kaylee Jones. She is speaking tonight at All Evenings with Authors at the Thurber House. Well, it's not at the Thurber House. It's at the Columbus Performing Arts Center, but it's through the Thurber House. For more information or where to purchase tickets, call the Thurber House at 614-464-1032. Or on the web, thurberhouse.org. You refer to your parents mostly in the third person throughout the book. Why do you do that? It's interesting.
Well, third person, my father, when he's, okay, first of all, I think if you write my father too much, it gets a little bit dull. And also, there's a difference for me between my dad, you know, James Jones is my father, but the writer, James Jones, is another figure entirely. It's like saying Hemingway or Fitzgerald or somebody like that, or, you know, Catherine Ann Porter. I mean, when I think about him as a writer, I think of him more like that, like, you know, Hemingway.
Apart from me. Yeah.
Apart from me. As a dad, he's my father always. And as the writer, he's also my father, but he is a figure in the canon of American literature. And as that, he's not my dad. He belongs to everybody. You know, he belongs to the American literary canon.
And so you would say things like Jim and Gloria.
Oh, well, that's more when I'm telling the story from my mother's point of view.
Okay.
You know, that was a choice I had to make, too, like to tell my mother's stories in the first person or the third person. I tried both. First person felt phony to me in the sense that I was not exactly repeating. It wasn't tape recorded. I didn't have a recorder of her stories. I only had her stories as perceived through the film of my memory. So already that's one step removed. So it was still she. You know, Gloria told these stories about herself and Jim. When she referred to my father, she always referred to him as Jim. When I was in the stories, then I had to switch it back to my father and my mother because I was there. So she's telling a story where I'm a participant in the story. So do I step in and give you my version of the story or her version of the story, you know, as she told the stories for years and years and years?
You're pretty meticulous, too. If you found another side of the story from somebody else, you would say so. You'd say, well, someone's...
I tried, but you know what happened is there were too many other people contradicting my mother's stories in the end, and I could have written a whole book on the contradictions of the stories my mother told. So I did when it was necessary to explain why something didn't gel, didn't match up. But there are many, many more instances of that I did not refer to in the book because it just would have taken the book in a whole other direction.
I have been talking with Kaylee Jones. She is the author of a memoir about her life as the child of James Jones and Gloria Jones. It is called Lies My Mother Never Told Me. Kaylee is speaking tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. If you would like more information, call the Thurber House at 614-464-1032 or thurberhouse.org on the web for more information. Kaylee, thanks for being with me. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, WOSU 820, NPR News.